Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. Listen on demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Now available free for both iPhone and Android devices.
This is a great guest. This is a perfect guest. It would have been a perfect guest on Monday. It's an even more important guest on this Thursday after the election. John Chachas with Lazard for years and with Credit Suisse and Merrill Lynch and doing banking and also with a different perspective. That's what happens when you're from Ely. Ely, Nevada. Population 4,000. Pat Nixon of a number of years ago was born there. What was Ely like 20, 30 years ago?
Well, Ely wasn't 4,000 people back then. It was probably closer to 10 or 11, and it was driven by
copper
and ranching and was a really vibrant, classic Western small-town existence. It was a terrific place to grow up.
How has it changed now?
Well, it's now much more, like the entire state of Nevada, I would say, much more dependent on government. A very large swath of Nevada residents are associated with either state or federal government in some way because environmental work has made it hard for the mines to function. Power plants that have tried to be developed out there have been stopped. I mean, it's just it's a different place.
And the federal government owns how much?
The federal government in Nevada probably is about 83% of the state. A huge number.
But the tilt here that you just described is a tilt from what we associate with a Republican Party to a Democratic Party ethos. And then we have this election. I would suggest it was remarkable. Your thoughts?
The election? Well, two things that people should remember. You know, in 2008, Barack Obama won by 8 percentage points across the country. He won by 2 this time, one of which went to a far libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson. So anybody who thinks that we didn't have a sort of 6% teaching moment should pay attention to the numbers. We also saw states like Virginia, Florida, Ohio, one or two others, which literally were 100,000 votes. So there was not, to me, a remarkable sea change as much as there was a surprise, and I am surprised, a validation and maintenance of the status quo. We just really didn't change very much.
The status quo is there, but then the parsing, as we just did with Joshua Green, is it a status quo of 4 more years, or as Joshua was suggesting in his cover article for Bloomberg Businessweek, it's going to be a very different tone in Washington?
I don't think so. I really don't buy that. Look, you have a president who has a very strong vision of the kind of country he thinks we should be, and you have a Republican House and people who came into the House and were reelected in the House with a very strong mandate to shrink the size of government. We now have in the Senate the same sort of composition, but we've added a couple like Liz Warren who are, you know, clearly the Harry Reid sort of left of center, progressive, government-oriented people. I think the fight is going to be engaged, and I really think it's going to be very tough to see people suddenly coming together to find that.
Well, I tell you one thing that did change. This is Timothy Homan in the Bloomberg Washington Bureau. Come January, for the first time in history, women and minorities will hold a majority of the Democratic Party's seats in the House, even though Republicans will still be the majority. And he goes on to say the visuals will be striking when the House debates whether to overhaul the country's tax code and considers ways to keep the cost of Social Security and Medicare under control. The white males of the Republican Party will be arguing to reduce benefits, while the women and minorities of the Democratic Party will make a case for keeping the nation's safety net where it is.
Well, you know, there's a great aphorism. You know, facts are not optional. And the facts are that the entitlement side of what we spend in America cannot continue to grow at the rate it has been growing. It cannot. It cannot be financed. We've run in 42 out of 47 years a deficit in this country. 42 out of the last 47, we have run a deficit. As a business, we would have been bankrupt and reorganized time and again. But of course, we're not a business. We can print our own money. I really find that, you know, this debate is going to be engaged because you cannot settle this deficit problem without fundamentally attacking the entitlement structure and changing what it looks like and having meaningful tax reform.
What will be the catalyst? I asked this of Martin Feldstein this morning, and he walked through some options like the marginal Chinese buyer disappears. What is the John Chachas catalyst?
You know, I hate to be negative, but I think on this one I have to go with the version that I think that there will be such dug-in positions on each side of this argument and very deeply felt. And add on top of that $2 billion of money spent demonizing the other side in this election. So a lot of hurt feelings. I think we're going to actually have sequestration on costs, and I think we're going to see the tax rates go up.
What's the downside of sequestration? I mean, something would happen. There would be hurt. There would be pain. But that would wake everybody up,
I think
that,
yeah, see, I think I've come around to your view. For a long time, I was in the camp of, geez, that's terrible. That's just an abdication of the 535 people that we send to Washington to do their job and actually come up with a sensible way to deal with this. Sequestration is sort of the, you know, the blunt object on the cost side, and just raising tax rates randomly across the board is the other, you know, the other side of that equation is the blunt object on that side. But it seems that, you're right, there may be a moment here where states like Virginia and Maryland and California and places that have government activities which keep people employed are going to wake up and find out that all this talk about how we want to simply reduce spending in the Defense Department or some narrow places in what the government does isn't practical. That the problem in the country is that from 1965 till today, entitlement spending has gone up 11.1 times over that time period. The GDP has grown at an average of sort of 3 times, you know, 3%. Mm-hmm. So these costs have just skyrocketed out of control, and at some way, this is going to force the conversation. I think your point is it's going to force the conversation.
John, you look at the future of Wall Street. Gary Parv Lazard talking the other day about things will just go away. The word he kept using, I hate the word synergy, that the synergies are done and there's just now an overcapacity. Is there an overcapacity?
Gary's a very smart guy, and he's known, he covers the financial services industry about as well as anybody possibly can, and I think he's right. I think we have, I mean, you look at the activities just in the last weeks of large integrated banks essentially getting out of lines of business, UBS closing down for all intents and purposes much of its investment banking practice, others sort of folding into to each other and combining. We do have a lot of overcapacity. I don't think this is going to be a happy time for the financial services.
Does it come back with a better real and nominal GDP, or is it removed from economic growth?
Well, there's probably some activity which is correction of having had too much growth in the industry overall during a period of years that just it needs to kind of filter through. But there's no question that profitability can come back if we have a more robust economic environment where people are financing, doing more transactions, money's moving. And I think for the most part, the people I spoke to the other night at and I was in Boston, was a pretty downtrodden, view that either if you're an equity investing person, less deal activity. If you're an advisor, less activity. Not a good time in financial services.
Yeah, and we had the story the other day that yet another bank is closing down its credit default swaps department to replace them with computers.
Well, look, you know, this Dodd-Frank bill was a disaster. Everybody think, you know, it was pages and pages of stuff that didn't really take risk out of the financial industry the way it was intended to. It created more bureaucracy. Maybe the one silver lining of Elizabeth Warren's election is she's now going to tangle with a dysfunction of the U.S. Senate rather than being in, you know, a despot sitting on top of the Consumer Protection Bureau that she helped to create. There's nothing good that's come out of financial regulation in the last year
but
and a half, in my view.
But she represents a constituency that's had it with finance for finance sake.
Yeah, I think there is a strong sentiment that Wall Street and banks, really lending banks, made lots and lots of mistakes that cost lots and lots of people lots of money. That said, you know, people have to realize that without the finance industry underpinning the rest of industry, we've got no economy. So the demonization of finance, of large banks as lenders and investment banks and deal makers kind of needs to stop.
What happens here, John? You know, 4 years ago, Wall Street essentially made a big bet on Barack Obama. You got lots of campaign money from Wall Street. What Wall Street got out of that was being demonized as, you know, fat cats, millionaires, and billionaires. They got nothing, basically. This time around, they made a big switch to Romney, and Romney lost.
Well, I think people with capital have to make rational decisions about their livelihoods. And I think the people with capital in this last election, what time's going to show, is most felt that a more regulated, more government-dominated economy wasn't in their best interest. And they fought hard for a candidate who they felt actually was about as clear and unabashed about the issues of industry as you could get. Romney and Ryan were very clear about the kind of world they thought we needed to kind of head to, and they came up short. So I don't see the financial services industry at least swinging back the other direction now. I mean, they're going to be walking this careful line, of course, because they didn't give lots of money to the system. The money that's in the political system is pretty scary. I mean, those are big dollars when you see $4, $5, $6 billion of money coming into the election cycle to choose the next leadership.
We had a couple of billboards on TV, and I literally had to figure out where the commas were.
Yeah, it's incredible.
There was so much money involved.
There are station owners. I'm a specialist in the TV business, and there are station owners I know who went into this cycle thinking that their TV station, for example, might make $7 or $8 million of extra money during the year from its normal level. So that alone is a huge tick up in that year. They made 20. I mean, the type of dollars that were deployed into video media, particularly television, was
did they work?
Yeah, of course, here in the tri-state area, we're blessedly unaware of any of that.
That's right. It's quite amazing.
Yeah.
We didn't really see much of it here, but in some of these swing states, you couldn't turn on a television in Ohio or in Nevada or Virginia or Florida.
Did it work?
I think that negative advertising, sad to say, actually has an effect. And if it's done well and early, can really define a candidate. And it was done in this instance exceedingly well in about 10 counties that really mattered.
Okay. Well, let's say the president was out early with a lot of money and did that, but then there was the follow-on of the hundreds of millions that you're talking about, and it would appear from the first exit polls I've seen in the beginning of studies that, A, there was a great turnout on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
That's by definition, that has to be good for America, to have people so engaged in the program.
I think anytime you can get more people voting in this country, you ought to. One of the things that should come out of this election is a real examination of how voting happens. People don't realize that 35 or so, I may get the number wrong by one or two, but an enormous number of states in this country are voting differently. Each state starts at a different day. Each one has a different approach to absentee ballots and to early vote, what standards are required. So I think there's going to have to be some approach to fixing this. But overall, getting people out to vote is a good thing.
Okay, let's leave it there. This has been, come back more often.
It's nice talking to you.
It's been very valuable, very valuable. John Chachas with Methuselah, and particularly looking there early on at the politics of it. He brings a wonderful, Ken, it's somewhat like you in the Carolinas. It is a twisted perspective from we of the Northeast.
It is different.
Is it Nevada or Nevada?
It depends if you're there. If you're from there, it's Nevada.
He corrected me last time he was here.
Did he?
Because I was saying Nevada.
Yeah. All right, John, thank you so much.
More storm fallout. Thank you, John.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.